where I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long ways of...
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. This is Shane R. Monroe, and you are listening to the December 2011 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Welcome to the program. Well, we're cutting it close this month. The holidays always make getting a show out rather ugly, but I think you'll be pleased with what we've put together. Next month's going to be a juggernaut of reviews. We have Dragon's Lair for Android. We've got the iCade arcade cabinet, the mini arcade cabaret-style cabinet. We got all sorts of good stuff coming next month. Unfortunately, those things had to get pushed back, but we still have a great show for you. First up, we have an interview with the greatest guy, David Thiel. He's a sound engineer and programmer, and this guy is fantastic. You're going to love listening to his stories. He's worked on pinball, classic arcade games, classic home console games. Trust me, you're going to love this. We actually have two different parts. It's that long. We spent a lot of time with him, and he's a fantastic interview. You're going to love it. We also have a new editorial commentary, Copyright Killer, Bringing the Dead Back to Life. Our usual bits and bytes. We're going to review Zen Pinball for the Android platform and also Atari's Greatest Hits for the Android platform. See what we're doing with classic gaming with modern technology. So, with that said, let's get on with the show. This month's editorial commentary, Copyright Killer, Bringing the Dead Back to Life, is my plea to interject some form of sensibility into the copyright law. As it stands, copyrights are almost indefinite. 75 years is a given, and there's really no way to challenge what could be considered a dead copyright. Let's look at it when you find money in the street. Legally speaking, if you find money in the street, you're supposed to put up signs, you're supposed to allow somebody to claim the money before you're allowed to actually keep it. There's some sort of legality, right? In that situation, you are allowed to keep money that you find laying out on the street, right? Look at the old games we have in MAME, right? The modern day MAME supports, what, 3,700 games? Now, those 3,700, sure, there's some Atari ones in there, there's Nintendo, there's Sega, but there's a whole lot of games in there that don't really have an owner anymore. They were created by some no-name company that's now out of business. The cabinets are dead and buried. A handful of collectors maybe have one or two machines. The ROMs were dumped and released. And technically speaking, it's still illegal to play these games on your system, on a MAME system, because the copyright law is still in effect, right? There should be some method of releasing copyright versus waiting 75 years. Here's my thought, all right? I'm going to call this the Released Copyright Act, all right? My goal would be have a global system in place where you register your desire to take this copyright. Let's say it's for some IRAM game, what is it, Astro Patrol or something like that in MAME. Let's say it's Astro Patrol. I know that may not be a real game. Astro Patrol in MAME from some company called IRAM, which no longer exists. You can't find it anywhere. You go up to this global system for released copyrights and say, I am laying claim to this copyright of this game. And, you know, you could do a search to see if somebody else has already laid claim to it. And you put it in the system, and it says, okay, we can't find any matches, so we're going to issue a preliminary release of copyright. At that point in time, there's a certain period of time, which would have to be discussed and come up with. The copyright is then released. Now, here's the cool part. Here's how you keep it safe. The copyright is completely released. In other words, it doesn't transfer to me. All I have done is said, I'm the person who's interested in it. I found the copyrighted material. I'm the one who would initially like to use it. I would like to register to do so. Now, the released copyright can't ever belong to anybody else other than the original copyright holder, but it releases all legal use of the product unless the original copyright holder comes forward and says, no, I want it back. At that point in time, it's stricken from the system. It's no longer considered a released copyright, and the original copyright holder can come back for it. So it's freely usable. Nobody gains any benefit of transferring of copyright. Now, I think it's perfectly acceptable to make money on this released copyright, as long as there's the understanding that anybody can do it, right? I go forward and I say, listen, I want to, propose to release the copyright on Astro Blaster, IREMS, the company that originally made it. Here's the name, and this is the product. It is a computer, or it's an electronic arcade video game, or whatever it is that comes up with, right? I request to have this released. And after a certain amount of time, I don't know, 30 days, 60 days, whatever, at some point in time, the system says, you know, we have held this in our system. We have publicly projected this. We have done whatever, right? Maybe you pay $50 to do it, and the system will actually print something in the New York Times, right? It prints a declaration in the New York Times that says, you know, Shane R. Monroe has requested release of copyright on a video game by the name of, you know, Astro Blaster from IRM. Anybody, you know, if the original copyright holder has any dispute, blah, 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 then you go to this website and you enter this code. And they can publicly dispute it. Right? So now we have a released copyright. We can still use these, and it's freely usable. Even if I were to go out and say, I'm going to build Dead Video Games Library, Volume 1, right, and I charge $10 for it, that's legal. You could go out and do the same thing. Anybody listening to me could go out and take the same game and make it legal. Make it a legal, purchasable copy. I could then start a company online that actually lets you purchase game ROMs that I will deliver to you, and it's considered legal unless the original copyright holder comes back to claim the released copyright. You know, I think systems that are dead systems like the Dreamcast, right? If you cannot purchase that system reasonably, I'm not talking eBay. I'm talking about going to a brick and mortar store or even going to Amazon directly, not through an Amazon affiliate. Whatever the criteria is, if a system cannot be purchased new in the box from a major retailer, it should be claimed dead, and the DMCA restriction, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the restriction that they offer of no reverse engineering should also go into play and say you are legally allowed to circumvent the DRM in these machines. That doesn't give you the right to go and play Shenmue or Crazy Taxi. Those are all still owned by Sega. But the legal ramifications of altering those boxes for homebrew, released copyright games, right? Those sort of things, I believe that should be in there. I believe that that makes sense. That it keeps property, it still keeps property safe for the people who have invested in it, but it also gives the end consumer an opportunity to get this content again, you know. I know that there's a whole bunch of ways that this system could be abused, but if in my vision, in a perfect world, this is how I would want to see copyright law handled. That's fine. You get a copyright for 75 years. You disappear off the face of the earth. You don't have an estate representing you. Your company dies. Nobody owns this any further, and you weren't absorbed by IBM or whatever. These things should be allowed to be freed. Even if they're jerked out from underneath you later on, at least there's an opportunity for people to experience this content. I don't know. What do you guys think? I'd love to hear, especially those of you who are very protective of IP or who are lawyers or legal type people. I would be very interested in hearing what your thoughts are on that. Of course, will it ever happen? Probably not. But the Sensible Released Copyright Act is what I'm shooting for. That's my next champion cause, is released copyright. So let me know what you guys think. Go over and contact us at the RetroGamingRadio.com website and let us know what you think. I'd be curious. This month we interview David Thiel, an interactive sound engineer. And you're going to find out exactly what that means when you listen to the interview. David Thiel's worked on classic video games, classic arcade games, classic pinball, and is currently working on modern pinball machines as a sound engineer. Believe me, I never thought I'd be this interested in hearing about sound technologies and engineering, but you know how our interviews go. We get talking, and then the sky's the limit. I hope you enjoy this interview with David Thiel. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio. I'm here with David Thiel, an interactive audio engineer. And even the title alone, David, brings me to my first set of questions. What exactly is an interactive audio engineer?
Well, he's an audio engineer and all that that encompasses. So audio is a discipline with many different capabilities, things you need to do. But when you layer interactivity on it, then you have to involve programming and the behavior of audio, which is in an interaction, you know, lively and non-deterministic. And you have to build the behavior of how the audio will work relative to itself and relative to the interaction. And so I've worked on console games, pinball machines, stand-up, coin-op, handheld devices. All of those are some kind of interaction, pre-designed something that a computer chip has enabled.
So instead of calling yourself a game engineer, a game audio engineer, or just a sound engineer, for you there's a different layer that goes deeper than just the audio.
Absolutely. Well, and for 7 years I was at Microsoft where I worked on interactive audio and absolutely nothing that was like a game. This was audio for non-game interaction, of which there is a lot of, and that's a field which is even less explored than game audio.
Well, let's go back to video gaming. My audience is primarily classic video gamers and a lot of pinball people that listen as well. So let's go back. Now, 1980, as I understand, was the first, well, 82 technically, when you worked on Reactor for Gottlieb, right?
Well, it was actually, I was hired late in 80, so 81 was the first real full year, and I was hired at Gottlieb, which is one of the last major pinball companies to get into their own game development. People mistakenly, when they think of video games, they think of Atari and all the stuff that happened in the Silicon Valley. They think of Japan. They don't think of Chicago as much. But there's a lot of game development, a lot of interaction done in Chicago because all the pinball companies primarily came from Chicago.
That's fascinating. And so Gottlieb, what was the, just so we get a frame of reference, what was a pinball machine released about the time that you started working there?
Probably Mars, God of War. That was a little bit, that was probably 8 months before. I'm trying to think of Haunted House.
Okay, that's probably a good reference. Most people know that pinball who are into pinball. And now I understand from watching your fantastic seminar, which I'm going to provide a link to if you guys are watching the show in the interactive HTML5 show, we'll go ahead and give you a link to that right now. You had 18 months before Gottlieb actually sat down and wanted to write a video game. Is that correct?
Well, not before. The context for this was Gottlieb, the pinball company, as a pinball company, very much believed video games were a fad, and they said so, and they didn't get into it with any enthusiasm. And all they did when forced by the parent company, see, they had been sold to Columbia Pictures. The Gottlieb family sold the company off to Columbia Pictures. And Columbia, the execs there, saw the writing on the wall, so Gottlieb half-heartedly got into video games. They purchased two Japanese video games and tried to sell them, and they were dreadful.
And I'm assuming these are not games that my listeners would probably know of.
No. New York.
But based on the Broadway production.
No. Basically, if you take Space Invaders And then if you have enough memory for a bitmap and you put a picture of the Statue of Liberty behind it, you have New York, New York.
Fantastic. Well,
and then they had a tank game. I can't think of the name of it right offhand, but it was equally forgettable. So they had a separate warehouse away from their pinball company, 10 miles away in Bensonville, where they had this warehouse and they had all of these boards of and cabinets of games they could not give away. And Columbia said, you have to have a video, you have to have a serious effort. You need to create your own stuff, as Williams had done and was doing. And Bally, on the other hand, had purchased Wisely and were doing quite well because they obviously had Space Invaders. And they had purchased Pac-Man, though they didn't want it.
Yes, that shows what they know, right?
Did you know that story?
It's kicking around in my head right now, but I don't remember the exact details.
I'm trying to think of the other game right off the top of my head, and I can't. But that was, not Rally X. No.
It was something to do with in order to get one, they had to buy the other.
The deal. And so they saw Pac-Man, and they didn't want that. They wanted the other one.
Right.
So they had to buy, 1,000 of this, and in order to get this, because you want this, you have to buy 1,000 Pac-Mans. Well, shows what people know early in the development of a medium as to, nobody has any criteria. Nobody knows what's fun. Will decide.
That's right. And unfortunately, you have to spend money before the market can give you that feedback. And well, look what happened with Pac-Man, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't build a business model on Pac-Man.
Now, I understand when you were working with Reactor, you were actually using a pinball board, the Votrex board?
Jim Weiss was the hardware engineer at Gottlieb who created this soundboard for pinball, and it was their first talking soundboard. Bally had the first talk, but they just brute forced the problem. They had very few number of phrases, and they just digitized it in a crufty way, compressed it somehow, and played back a few things. I think that was Susan Ciani and Xenon, maybe? In any case, that was the first talking pinball. So Gottlieb took a different approach and used the Votrex chip, which was a speech synthesizer chip, and they could talk a lot. I mean, it sounded dreadful, but they could say a lot. And
right.
I inherited that soundboard, which they had by that time maybe done two or three pinball games on. And that was also, for the majority of the games that I did, that was also the same board.
Before we talk about the fun that you had using that board with Q-Bird, because there's tons of lore around Q-Bird that I know you can talk to us about. Personally, as a gamer, and as sort of an early developer, I used to develop games on the Commodore 64 and the Amiga and whatnot back in that time frame. I really felt speech was important to the progression of gaming, technologically speaking. I felt that it endeared or offered some sort of a companionship to the gamer that standard sound effects alone didn't offer. Now, most people will completely disagree with me. They think that speech is just completely superfluous. It's tacked on like motion control in a video game, and they don't care one way or the other. But I'm really curious, as a sound guy, especially your interaction at this early stage, how did you feel about speech back then?
Well, management forced it on me, frankly.
So you probably weren't all that pleased.
Well, okay. The board talked. Reactor was going to talk. And actually, the way we used it, I mean, I try to use things functionally.
Sure.
Because I have a limited number of resources, and I want to devote my resources to things that are functional as part of the contract between the game design and the player. So I want to be using this to inform the player. If I'm going to get your attention, I want to have something useful to say.
Sure, and that's totally makes sense to me.
So, and speech clearly can do that really well, but it is like it's small arms. I think of music as the hand grenade of sound design, and then speech is kind of like a mortar. If you're going to use it and you're going to get somebody's attention, the user better want that information, and you better present it in such a way that they understand it and that they're grateful that you got their attention and said something to them.
So
you use the Votrax chip. It only marginally sounds like speech.
Right.
It's sort of, and the other part of speech, human beings are incredibly sensitive to speech as a channel of communication.
Right.
And somebody who has a lisp, let's say, has a handicap, right? A human being who has a hard time speaking normally.
Sure.
There are a lot of jobs for which they couldn't even do socially.
Social implications, sure.
Yeah. So we're very, very sensitive to the speech channel, and we don't accept bogus stuff very gracefully. I mean, after the novelty of, oh, look, a computer's talking, after that's over, then you people are pretty critical. It needs to be done well, or you shouldn't do it. So that's kind of why I wasn't all that pleased. Then it was also just technically difficult because there were no tools. There was no way to automate this procedure. The Votrax chip had an inventory of 64 phonemes. If you look at a dictionary and see how they break up words, that's a
right.
phoneme. And that was my tool. I went to a dictionary and tried to map dictionary phonemes to what the Votrax could do and then turn it loose and see what it said.
It's interesting that nobody, and I don't know, maybe they did at some point in time. It would seem to me that if there were 64, I mean, that's a fairly finite number, that somebody didn't have some sort of a chart or something on the wall that basically said, if you want to say hello, then it's, because I know you mentioned that later on, I don't want to skip ahead too much in the story, but you said later on that you actually sent it numbers, and numbers corresponded to the pieces of speech. So you'd send it two or three numbers, and that would give you the word hello. I would think you'd almost have like a dictionary lookup system at some point on the wall, at least, that would make that somewhat easier for you.
Well, yeah, but you have a whole lot of words, right? I mean, you can do the hello world with it, and you can understand the mapping at some base level. But when
right.
you want to expand the vocabulary to say a bunch of stuff, it's just, you break it down to phonemes. But the problem lies in saying, okay, well, these are the first obvious choices that
right.
this phoneme in English maps to this phoneme on the Votrax chip, and I string them together and I turn it loose, and when it says it, it's marginally understandable or doesn't even sound like it or sounds wrong.
Well, let's move on then to that reactor then that you were talking about. Because just as a good segue from here, you were having trouble getting reactor to say what you wanted.
Yeah. Well, Reactor was, I had originally been hired at Gottlieb as a programmer, just a programmer, and I originally did some of the sprite utilities. Understand, three development systems at Gottlieb. One was a very expensive Intel Blue Box, which is really a hardware design tool that did it did a hardware emulation of the 8088 chip. And you could also develop software with it, but each dev station in that day was probably 15 grand. So, not
wow.
that many people got their hand, and that's in 1980 dollars. So think 65, 70 grand in today's dollars. Then there was an equivalent for the soundboard called Rockwell had a blue box for the 6502. And then the Apple II. The Apple II was my development station, for everything. For an awful lot of what I did at Gottlieb Mildstar.
Why the Apple II over, say, a Commodore 64 that definitely would have better sound, I would think?
Well, there was no Commodore 64 in 1980.
Oh, okay. My numbers were just a little off there. But they had an Apple II back then, not the IIe, but the original.
Yeah, the Apple II. And you could crank, you put 48K of memory in it. And,
gotcha.
You could have a real disk drive. And you had parallel port. So you had what you needed. And, in fact, Jim Weiss designed a ROM emulation board that plugged into the Apple II bus that could simulate, that could be a 2K EEPROM.
Oh, very nice. So, yeah, sort of a jack-of-all-trade box you had there then.
Well, and the soundboard was a 6502, so I didn't need a cross assembler. I just used the 6502. I used an assembler that I had and a text editor that I had on the 6502, created binaries. Had the destination of the binaries be in the memory space where the ROM emulator was, and I was good to go. So I never burned EEPROMs to do sound development. That would be death.
I was just going to say, what a pain that would have been.
Yeah, you can't do that. It just takes way too long. And since it was in my memory space, then I could also build utilities to give me what I think of as virtual knobs that I could isolate memory locations which had variables which would affect some property of the audio. And so while the sound is running, I could go in and poke those variables and change things. And I thought of them as like a knob.
So you had essentially a virtual mixing board by the time you were done with it. You could do all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. And that was my early experience. And I was never tolerant from that point on of any system that put a compile link cycle between me and what I was trying to do, because that's just too cumbersome. It takes too much. I needed to be able to, while the thing was running, adjust things.
Oddly enough, it seems that technology in that respect, as we moved kind of forward to that type of development, I don't want to get too technical. My listeners are might be getting glassy-eyed now, but hey, listen, folks, I want to hear this stuff, so you get to hear it. It's funny because as we move forward now, you know, to build even a simple game takes sometimes hours to let it all go through. And if you had to do that each time you wanted to listen to what you'd done.
So you have to, as a developer, you have to short circuit that. I mean, even on the most sophisticated systems, you eventually know where things live in memory. You have some address table, you have something. So you got to be able to find the magic locations where there are adjustable parameters. I mean, you build your system so that there are adjustable parameters, then you need to, whatever system you're working on, figure out where they are so that you can adjust them at runtime. And short-circuit that whole assemble, edit, assemble, compile, link, load, run cycle that can take, 15 minutes.
Are you what would be considered a clean developer, or do you like going in and doing things that the original hardware really shouldn't have done to begin with to get your results?
I'm pragmatic. A lot of the things we did were never intended to have been done.
Right.
And I very much admired, let's say, the 2600 guys. That was a breakout machine, right? It was built basically so it could play breakout. And by doing some of the most incredible programming gymnastics, you end up with side-scrolling games.
Right.
There's no bitmap on that machine. How in the world are they drawing a moving background behind the sprites that they have, Well, because they're doing this insane programming where they're changing the color of a line on the fly.
Right.
So that they can draw something that's vaguely like a river for a river raid or whatever. And so, that's an example taken to the extreme. There were half dozen programmers in the universe who could do that trick on a 2600.
Well, for an example, just for my listeners who may not know what I'm sort of getting at, the SID chip on the Commodore 64 allowed you to do some very weird things with it.
Mm-hmm.
But those sort of things didn't translate very well, say, when you moved to a Commodore 128 because of some timing issues or even emulation later on. Yeah. You could load up a game and go, man, this doesn't even sound anything like I remember it. Even though it's full emulation, it still doesn't sound right.
Well, I've heard some of the game. The game that was most – let's jump to that for a second.
Please.
I never even thought about whether they had intended it or not. But SID had a feature where it was memory mapped. And so you could write the contents of – that chip as fast as you could write memory. Now, that's not true for most audio chips.
Right.
There's a pipeline inside an audio chip, and so if you have some parameter change or something you want to do, you can write it, and it'll get to it when it gets to it. So basically, things like that are latched. You write it into the chip, and eventually the chip gets around to taking the value that you latched into it. But a SID, the way it was designed, was like a memory part. So all of its registers could be written really, really, really fast. And there weren't that many of them, relatively speaking. I don't know, maybe there's 48 or 64 registers for a SID chip. So I took that all the way in Rock and Bolt, where I had a Rock and Bolt features 6-channel audio. Now, how can you do that? Because SID only has 3 channels.
Plus the fourth for wave noise, right? For white noise? Was that correct? Is that the Amiga?
No.
I don't remember.
Yeah, that's just SID has – SID basically – SID's a fantastic chip. I have a lot of SID stories. I have a very sad Sid story, which we can talk about. But Sid is like three mini Moogs. That was the first real usable synthesizer from Moog.
Right.
And Sid has the capability, not of a complete mini Moog, but mini Moog could make one sound at a time.
Right.
Sid could make three sounds at a time, each one with many of the capabilities of a mini Moog under digital control. It was a fantastic chip.
It definitely showed. Just the sheer amazing ways that they did game. I mean, that they made games with the Sid chip in terms of audio was insane.
Yeah. There was nothing like it. Sid was a fantastic chip, but it only could do it. You know, it did three things at a time. Well, there's this phenomenon that I exploited. And from early games, one of the things people don't realize, let's go to a Williams game like Robotron.
Love me Robotron.
Yeah, love me some Robotron. Or Stargate, or what's the Defender.
Defender, right.
You have to understand, that was the same system as I was using at Gottlieb, meaning it's just a processor and a converter, something that takes numbers and turns them into a voltage, and you stick that voltage on a speaker. So you're literally controlling the position of the speaker cone. That's what you have.
That's so crazy. I never really thought of it that way.
That's all you got, right? You can.
Wow.
You have, it was an 8-bit DAC, so you had 256 positions of speaker cone. And I think it was signed. So 0 is the cone at rest.
And right.
127 is the cone all the way to one extreme, and negative 128 was the cone all the way to the other end. That's what you got. Now, by programming the way you move air, you make sound. And it was that fundamental. So anything you were clever enough to do within the constraints of how complex a program you could write to move that cone in an interesting way, you could make sound. And it's a completely fluid, and you could make anything that you were clever enough to make within the constraints. But you have an 8-bit processor. You have to dedicate that processor to that program of whatever it's doing. So
sure.
You really can't do more than one of those at a time. Now think about that. Think about Robotron or Defender or Stargate or any of the things that I did in that period. There's never more than one sound program running at a time.
You're right. There's
but that's amazing. It sounds so much richer.
It does. I mean, Robotron is, to me, Williams games, and believe me, no offense to the stuff you worked on, because Gottlieb stuff is very much similar, are probably the most recognizable sounds in video game history, in my opinion.
Well, and that's because they're so soft. They're programs. They're just the raw imagination of the people writing the programs to move that speaker around.
So crazy. I had no idea that's how that worked.
So the guy at Williams who built an awful lot of the sounds is a guy named Sam Dicker, who ended up writing the sound system and doing a lot of stuff at Cinema, at Amiga.
Makes sense.
But he never committed himself. He was a programmer who did audio stuff, and he never fully committed himself to being, you know, the audio guy. He just was a programmer who did the audio library. But I learned, you know, I hadn't even met Sam until many years after I was gone from Gottlieb. But I certainly admired his work because he had already done a bunch of stuff before I had even been hired there. So I want to give credit where he was one of the guys. And see, I'm trying to think, besides Williams and Gottlieb, there were very few companies that took this approach. All the Japanese companies took a hardware approach to audio for video games.
Right. And they all kind of sound similar.
Well, they're okay. With the exception of Pac-Man and some of the things from Namco, there was a TI chip.
Right.
It's a square wave chip. It makes, that's what you were thinking of. It makes three square waves.
Right.
And a noise channel.
There you go. All right. That makes me feel a little better.
Mm-hmm.
My memory's not failing me.
You know, in square wave, you know, in the digital world, that's like falling off a log. Anything can make a square wave. It's from the number of hard transistors you need to make a square wave generator as opposed to a synthesizer. It's a piece of cake. That's the good news. The bad news is it sounds like a square wave. Square wave is all the odd harmonics. It's particularly great, and so it's a very both bassy and bright sound at the same time. It's very cutting. You know, in some ways, it's appropriate for an arcade, but it's really hard to make it sound interesting or pleasant or anything else. And all you really can do in that time is goof with frequency.
Right.
Because you have no other, you know, there are all these properties of audio, and frequency and volume are the two. And it provided extremely coarse control of volume and control over frequency. And so these are the only two properties that you can play with.
But Sid had a lot of other things, though, right? I mean, Sid had the whole attack sustain, attack decay sustain release way envelope.
And... So that's for volume. It had much more sophisticated ways of dealing with volume, and then it had different timbres, different waveforms. It had a square wave, but it had a sine wave, and it had a ramp, and all these things sound different. You can use those properties to make interesting sound. Plus, the square wave, that assumes 50-50, that it's square, you know, it's on 50% of the time and it's off. If you can change that percentage, if you can narrow that thing down to a pulse, that's a very interesting sound. And Sid provided that too.
And amazing little chip, that thing.
It was amazing. So in any case, go all the way back to Rockin' Bull. I finally built a system. So the important fact here is that you can only play one sound at a time, right? But the way the human mind works is if a sound's going on and it gets interrupted by another sound that's new and interesting, the human mind doesn't go, wait, they just stopped sound number one. I'm offended. That's not the way the human mind works. The human mind goes, oh, look, there's a new sound. This one must be much louder than that one. And that's why I hear sound number two.
Interesting. And that's the kind of the principle that the Williams games and probably Reactor and Qbert did as well, right?
Yeah. That's the first thing you have to understand. I mean, intellectually, it offends me that I can only make one sound at a time. And I'm thinking people are going to object to this and people are going to notice. And it's going to really degrade the suspension of disbelief that I'm trying to create here. But that's not the way the brain works. The brain just goes, oh, new sound. That must be much louder. And it's masked.
That's so weird.
That's what happens in reality, right? Sounds mask other sounds. Or new sounds, because of their novelty, catch our attention. And so the other sound is still going on. We're not really giving our attention to it. We're involved in the new sound.
The psychology of sound.
Well, if you're going to do interaction for people, you had better start studying perception. Because that's your meat and potatoes, right?
That's just visual. Aren't people ever able to play Robotron the same way now?
It's truly amazing. Okay, how many stars are in the star field of Defender?
It's probably only one.
No.
But they just turn on and off quick enough to where you think it's more than one, right?
Well, no. But it looks like a lot of stars because
it looks like a lot.
There's 16. Right. But you think there's a lot more than 16, right?
Right.
That's just another one of those phenomena. And so all these phenomena of human perception, the way the wiring, the way humans behave, game guys have to be attuned to that and exploit those whenever possible.
You know, it's so funny. Just as a little side story, I interviewed David Crane a few years back. And, of course, he's just genius. Everything about him is genius. But he was telling me about the way that he played with colors. Just by putting a certain type of border or a certain color of border around their Activision games, they were able to make the colors look better.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same sort of idea. I never really thought, you know, that you could exploit that kind of human perception. It fascinates me to no end that you can do that with sound, too.
Yeah, so to finish up the Rock and Bolt thing for completeness, the way the Rock and Bolt sound system works, it works on that same principle. Ultimately, I can only ever have three sounds going at a time. But all the one-shots, all the sound effects, run in the virtual channels. So I'm playing music using three channels continuously in the background, something you wanted to do, right? But when a sound effect comes in because there's a collision or you get some points or whatever, that goes in and steals one of the channels playing music for the duration of the sound effect. And as soon as the sound effect's done, because of the design of the SID chip, I was able to restore everything because that had been continuing to run. It just hadn't been getting that data. It had been getting a data from a sound effects data stream. So as soon as that was done, it would restore the music.
And the in your mind I don't remember Rock and Bold well enough to be honest with you.
Right.
It's been a while. But I would think that would as you would say offend the senses to have one of the music voices drop like that.
You don't notice it.
Man, it's crazy. I got to write this down so I can go and check that out.
It's cool. You don't notice it. I mean, okay, you could design music that would be offensive if you had long, flowing music with really long things. You know, it is content sensitive.
Okay.
But if you have anything that's got a little rhythm and of course appropriate video game music, subject to energy.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the functions of having music at all is it provides some, you know, energy and some action.
So did you actually, now just to round that off, did you actually compose the music specifically mm-hmm. because you were going to steal those channels?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Right. So it wasn't just a, oh, wow, look what I managed to pull off. It was like you had that plan from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. But it would have worked for a broad class of music. The this trick would have worked for a lot of stuff. And that was one of the last original products that I did on the C64, so I never really got to exploit that anymore.
That's too bad, too. It seems like there's a lot of stories like that that go around.
Yeah.
People, just when they got things figured out, they moved on.
Yeah.
That's so sad. Imagine what you could have done.
You know, the market is a fickle thing. I mean, the other thing, I have a little thing about how disk drives crushed both Commodore and Atari.
Really?
The Atari 800 or the C64, either of those machines should have crushed the Apple II.
Right. What's your theory? I've got a theory, too.
Well,
I'm curious how they line up.
It's real simple. Really, it's because of the federal government, right? It's because of the FCC. Because the parallel connection to a disk drive that gives it reasonable performance is difficult to make cheaply without it turning into an antenna and sending out all kinds of hash.
Hmm. Okay.
So you have to remember, the original Apple II did not sell with a composite video connector. You had to buy an adapter.
Right. I remember
because
that.
Apple couldn't sell it with a consumer video out, because then it would have been subject to the FCC's prohibition on the cable that came from the disk drive.
Okay.
So
I'm
they sold
now.
This, you know, it was such a hobby thing, right? They sold this $25 adapter that you attached to the video output that gave you something, allowed you to connect it to a TV.
Gotcha.
And that
I wonder if that's why the Amiga did that too, now that I think about it, the 501 video adapter. I wonder if that's why. Never mind. I digress. Go ahead.
Okay. So Commodore and Atari both decided not to, you know, they were going to be legit. So that meant they couldn't and they didn't attach their disk drives in a parallel fashion to the computer.
They used serial.
Much slower. Like a factor
my God.
Of 10 slower. Even though these were, quote, intelligent disk drives. I mean, they were computers, right?
Yeah, they had 2K of memory just on the 64 drive, right?
Right. Right.
Of its own.
The Atari drive was an intelligent drive, too, and they could run a nice thin little cable to it and stuff, but they were way slow. They were below threshold for anything but a game. You know, if you load a game and it takes 5 minutes or so, you know, you tolerate that because you're going to play for an hour.
Yeah.
But if you're going to load a word processing dock, do anything, you know, useful with it, you're going back and forth to the disk all the time. And that's why the Apple prospered, and that's in something other than a toy, other than a game, and neither the Atari nor the C64 did. When either of those computers, taken in the totality, were better machines, better graphics, better sounds, faster, better in every way than an Apple II, they could never be taken seriously as a productivity tool because of the way the disk drives attached to them. That's my theory.
Fascinating. And here it was, I just thought, because Apple II product dumped all their crap into schools, that's how it managed to stay alive.
But that didn't hurt. That didn't hurt, but fundamentally, you know, you couldn't take them serious. Actually, we did a focus group once, and one of the guys who was at the focus group was some kind of construction guy, and he was actually running his business on a C64 with a couple drives.
Sure.
And, you know, so there was always somebody out there who will do it, who's patient, who's cheap enough and patient enough to do it. But,
right,
you know, it just was a non-go, not, it just was not going to happen.
So
crazy. And frankly, the Amiga, which should have crushed the Mac.
To be sure.
The Amiga is a much better computer than the original Mac in every
Absolutely.
Way.
Yeah.
Didn't. Not because of so much how they attached the disk drive, but because the operating system they bought was like this virtual operating system that wrote all the contents to the Amiga disk drive as a linked list.
Hmm.
Which is perfectly appropriate and an interesting technique to use if you have a hard drive. But if you've got a floppy, trying to read, you know, you say cat, give me a catalog, show me what's on the disk.
Right.
But on an Amiga, it had to like scan enormous chunks of the disk because the directory wasn't in any one place where you could just go and get it and display.
Right.
You had to go through this linked list all over the disk. So
gotcha.
The Amiga appeared to have this just terrible slow behavior.
Right. Well, that's probably why, like, every single game developer wrote their own disk operating system for every game they put out.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to have to deal with the Amigas.
Yeah, so Commodore always had trouble with disks. And they, you know, they should have done so much better. And as a developer, then, you vote with your efforts. You say, okay, this looks hot. Let's do some stuff on this. And if the platform prospers, we prosper.
Sure.
So you can't help but be a little bitter.
Trust me, I'm a Commodore guy, tried and true, and I've been more bitter about Commodore and their silly decisions than probably anybody else. So
yeah.
I'm but that's just from a consumer point of view. You would have all sorts of different, I'm sure, peeves with them with regards to development.
Yeah. So let's go all the way back to Reactor.
All right, back to Reactor. Now that we've managed to segue for 20 minutes, that's perfect.
Okay. So back to Reactor. So I was writing graphics utilities on the Apple II. For the Sprite system, and Tim Skelly was getting close enough to have a game that was working and it, you know, hit detection and it was playing and stuff, and then they all looked around and said, "But who will do sound?"
And that was you.
I raised my hand. I said, "I can do this." And so I got the soundboard from the pinball division. We still weren't in the same building at that time, so a truck showed up and gave me a pinball soundboard, and gave me some example source code of this is how you do this, and it was off to the races.
Now let's go back. I know we keep going back to Reactor, but back to yourself personally. Now, did you have an audio background before programming?
Sure. I graduated from college with a degree in technical theater, but prior to college, when I was in high school, I'd been in rock bands. And I was playing, my summers, I was playing in bands during the summer between college semesters. And when I graduated with this degree in technical theater, I said, well, I'm going to do what I do best and what I like to do. And so I joined a band, and I played in bands, different kinds of bands, rock bands, lounge bands, show bands, 5 days, 6 days a week. 5 to 6 hours a night for 5-6 years.
So there's a large component of you that's audio related. And how did you end up then getting in being a programmer if that was sort of your initial passion?
Well, the whole playing live music, which, you know, if you've been born in the last 20 years, it's an environment here, children, use your imagination. This is what it used to be like.
Right.
Every hotel chain and every small bar used to have a lounge, and they used to have live human beings in there, 2, 3, 4, 5, playing music for people to dance and drink to 5 or 6 nights a week all over America. And this was true for quite some time. And so that's where I was able to, you know, I could play and I could sing, and I wanted to do that. So I did that for quite some time, but eventually it was subject to automation.
Sure.
The cheap amplifier, the cassette tape, the turntable came in, and disco, specifically, and then the DJ pretty much wiped out three quarters of the venues that had had live music. It just went away over a period of like 2 or 3 years.
So you were riffed, I guess, out of the industry.
And the job that I got, the first day job that I had ever had since college, was a company called the Electric Keyboard, all K's. And they sold electric keyboards. They sold synthesizers back in the day when they were pretty much just mono. They only made one sound at a time. So we Moog and Arp and Korg and Roland, we sold all these synthesizers. It was like a boutique kind of shop, and it was unique in the United States. There was only one other in L.A. or New York that did such a thing. We didn't sell home organs or pianos. We were a music store that only sold this cutting-edge synthesizer stuff. Hmm. So I was retail and a demonstrator. I mean, I had a background where I could do that.
Right.
I had used a synthesizer for years in playing out live. I had a Arp Odyssey, two-channel thing. And the other half of the store was the first Apple II dealer in Chicago.
Hmm.
And I was also a wannabe computer hobbyist. I built my first computer, which was an RCA CMOS 20, I forget what the number of the chip was. You know, and all it had on it was a keypad, which allowed you to put in hexadecimal numbers and a couple digits display.
Old school.
Yeah, way old school. And I built this myself, and I got it to the point where I could put the Starship Enterprise in blocks, black and white blocks on the screen. That was my crowning achievement.
That's fantastic.
And you had to enter the data in, you know, and there was no way to save the data.
Right. Every time you shut the thing off, you had to do it again.
Yeah. So I was I really, really wanted to have my own computer. So here I am at an Apple II dealer. Now, this is prior to the time that Wozniak had even released the disk drive. So the Apple II that we sold was 16K and interfaced with a tape recorder to save stuff.
Right.
And it, you know, cost $1,000.
Just amazing.
$1,978.
Ugh.
But there
There's
was
your
some,
third mortgage there.
Yeah, so and we had terrible winters in Chicago at that time, and no customers because the couldn't even drive around. But I had a front wheel drive Rabbit, so I was able to get to the place, and so I would have 6 hours with no customers. And so I spent all my time in the back learning how to program. So I learned programming that. The 2 years that I was at the Electric Keyboard. I also had great mentors. I don't know if you know the name Chris Oberth?
Doesn't ring a bell, no.
Well, Chris was one of the first guys who created all kinds of games for the Apple II. They used to, you know, you make the disc and you stick them in a plastic bag with a piece of paper, and they were sold at computer stores.
Yeah, the old early Lord British stuff there.
Yeah. Chris did a ton of games.
Wow.
And then he ended up I worked with him later on at Action Graphics. He worked on Winter Games. Actually, yeah, which thing did he do? He did the speed racing, I think.
Gotcha.
Okay. But, so, Chris is a real pioneer. He also did some games for, was it Stern? I guess it was Stern. When Stern, you know, post-Berserk Stern.
Right.
When they still had a video game division.
Right.
So, Chris was there, and, you know, he was I learned a lot from Chris, and then there's another guy there, and so I learned really the nuts and bolts of programming on an Apple II. I mean, of course, there was a disk drive, and the first day the guy walked in with VisiCalc, that was amazing.
Now, explain to my younger listeners what exactly programming was back then. We're not talking about, you know, .NET framework. We're talking about hardcore 6502 type assembler, right?
Yeah. Well, there were three styles, right? You could get down and dirty, and you had to have a map of the code that was in ROM to exploit that on the Apple II. That was really your class library, if you will. But you could program in BASIC, and there were floating point BASIC and integer BASIC. So you had a language that could only do integer numbers. No fractions allowed.
How fun is it to make, like, physics type stuff with only integer numbers?
Not fun.
Not fun.
You don't do it. You avoid it at all costs. See, I'm a theater major and a programmer, and I never had that much math. So this kind of programming really suited me because I was on machines that could barely do math. So, you know, we had to figure out other ways of doing things.
You and me both, my friend. You and me both.
Formulas need not apply because there's no good way of even putting them in the machine. But then if you get down to 6502, that was a fun language. There were two armed camps at that time. There was the 6502 camp and the Z80 camp, the AD80 or Z80 camp. And depending on which machines you liked and stuff, these were assembly languages, and you picked one typically. And I very much liked the 6502 because it was very simple. And really, it is the first RISC language, reduced instruction, whatever that stands for.
Right.
Because it has very few instructions, and they execute really, really fast. So even though the clock rate on, you know, how fast instructions are executed is typically low, a 1 megahertz 6502 programmed well would do more work than a 4 megahertz Z80.
Right.
Because the instructions, you know, you start exploiting zero page and all these crazy modes, you could really get throughput on a 6502.
Didn't 6502, now again, this is not my realm of expertise, but it seemed to me that there were a lot more like Z80 arcade games and there were a lot more 6502 home systems. Would that be a fair statement?
That would be a fair statement. You know, the Trash 80 was Z80. So, you know, the stuff done on the Radio Shack computer was Z80. But you're right. Atari, Apple II, Commodore are all 6502.
Wasn't Coleco and Coleco Adam 6502 as well, or no?
No, that's Z80. No.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, Coleco Adam. So, I mean, the Japanese were much more fond of the Z80 than the 6502. It really comes down to that. So it depended who, you know, designed your hardware.
Sure. Okay, so how far do we manage to digress off reactor this time?
Oh, pretty far. Yeah, reactor must be an incredibly boring subject.
Oh,
just
absolutely.
Not getting there.
Absolutely.
So in any case, you know, it got to the point, I said, I'll do the sound. So we worked on reactor, and we worked really hard, and then at some point, you know, it came down from above. Reactor has a speech chip on it. You will make this talk, son. I'm just new at this company. I've only now been there 6 months. And, yes, sir.
That's right. I'll do it.
Is there anything you want? So I did it, and it was not rewarding because no matter what you did with it, it was not going to sound good. And keep in mind, the novelty was off. The fact that a computer was talking, you know, okay, show me something new. And besides the fact of it misforming and mispronouncing and doing bad stuff, the other thing that we use speech for, it's a carrier for emotion. Yeah, I can say something to you six different ways. I think you look nice today. I think you look nice today.
Right.
I think you look nice today. You know, and so there's a whole other channel that's laid on top of language, which is prosody and speech and the way it's done. And also the speaker.
Sure. Fidelity.
Well, no, but more than that, I mean, you think about something like Seth MacFarlane. There's a guy who can do about 10 different characters that are like really far apart from each other.
And he can do it all at once. He doesn't have to use multiple tracks for that. It's amazing.
Oh, no, yeah. He can have a conversation with himself. He's a scary guy.
That's a whole other piece that I hope we have time to get to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was Family Guy. I got to do that. So, in any case, given all those things, the Votrax is devoid of everything. It has this one way it can speak, and it doesn't speak well, so I was not happy. And then I got to the point where there was a place in the game where you could push the enemies into these little side chambers, and they would bounce around, and that was the bonus chamber. And every time they hit the wall, they took some damage, and you got points. And when you got so many points, you would cross a threshold, like 5,000 points or 10,000 points. So that was a nice opportunity because your eyes are probably somewhere else. You're not looking at the bones chamber with the thing. You're over here trying to stay alive.
Sure.
So it's a great opportunity in the sound channel to give you information that you care about, but it's not critical.
Sure.
So it's a nice time to, you know, stroke the player and reward them and say, oh, you've just gotten 5,000 points because you... So we eventually determined with the script what we wanted to do was say the number of bonus points. 5,000 bonus points. 10,000 bonus points. 1,000 bonus points. So I tried to program the Voltrax to do that. I'm pretty sure, I can't say for a certainty, but after... 16 working hours at trying to say bonus points, it would only say bogus points.
That's such a great story.
1,000 bogus points. And I would try everything. I mean, after the obvious thing out of the dictionary didn't work, then you start getting creative, and I substituted all kinds of stuff. And then there's another phenomenon we're working on things, but particularly sound, called habituation, where after you work on a thing, you begin to habituate on it, and you think, oh, yeah, I've got it. It's doing it. You get so familiar with it. And this is a very frustrating phenomenon because somebody would walk through my lab, and I'm, come here, come here, come here, come here. And then I would play it for them. And then they would go, what are bogus points?
But you actually, at that point, were hearing bonus at that point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you do. The phenomenon of habituation... You can understand things that other, if you hadn't been working on it, wouldn't make any sense.
Right.
So you got to walk away, right? But I mean, I'm under the gun to get this thing done, so you know, you just keep working and working. So at some point, we just drop bonus from the phrase. I think we just 1,000 points, and that sort of worked. But born of that frustration was at some point I couldn't stand it anymore, and Chris Brewer, who was my tech at the time. He offhanded said, well, gee, I wonder what happened if you just send it random numbers, which would mean random phonemes, right?
Because right.
It's a one-to-one mapping between phonemes and numbers. And so we did that, and it sounded great. I mean, obviously it wasn't understandable, but it sounded great. It made this great alien voice. And then you could vary it, right? The number of phonemes you sent it, the pacing that you sent it. We also could control the pitch of the chip. So we could, you know, make different voices, and we had this, and it had, you know, this is great. In parallel with this, Warren Davis was working on his first game, and he'd gotten some art from Jeff Lee, and he was beginning to turn it into a game. And so I saw this orange character jumping around on this tessellated field, and I didn't know Warren very well, and I said, Warren, I'm going to be your sound guy, and boy, do I have something for you.
Warren's told me the story of Qbert, but he never told me about. I mean, he told me that it was random, but he never really gave me the backstory of it, like you've gotten to do.
Yeah. So the voice was created independently of Qbert, had nothing to do with it. But
right.
As soon as I saw Qbert and the other characters, I said, "Oh, this is perfect, and we can use this functionally." That was the other thing, right? Because I could make different voices, and they had, you know, the very annoying small character and the very big character, I could pitch the voices, and I could use the middle voice, which was the everyman's voice, for Qbert, so he could talk. So when you could hear the low voice, but you didn't see anything yet, as a player, you would know to direct your attention to the edge of the pyramid.
Right.
Because something was going to come on.
It was an audible cue.
Yeah. So I like that. I mean, I insist on that if at all possible. You can just decorate something, but that's not enough. The audio is too important of a channel to the player to just use it for decoration.
Do you feel, while we're on this topic, I want to get a little philosophical with you. Do you feel that we all know that when you have to code in a smaller environment, a tighter closed environment, you're forced to be a little more creative. And I think that that's why the earlier games tend to be still playable. Do you feel that as technology moved forward, that games, especially like today, right? I mean, look at Modern Warfare 3. I mean, it is an audible feast, but do you feel that they have become, decorators with that sort of technology?
Well, to be fair, my survey of modern games is limited. I am crazy in depth on the Halo franchise.
Okay, fair enough. Same idea.
I'm very, very deep, and so I can speak to how they use audio.
All right.
And I play Halo Wars as well, which is a different, same content, different game, different studio.
Sure.
I know how they use it. And I've done a survey. I played some other stuff. And, you know, there's good and there's bad in what's going on. Clearly, production values have gone wildly up.
Right.
And it's a function of pre-rendering. The way I think of it is pre-rendering. I mean, when I make sound in Reactor, or I made sound in a pinball machine or a coin-op machine or any of these things, you know, up to some point, the machine was creating the sound on the fly in the cabinet at the time. And that has some nice properties, but it's huge constraints, right?
Yeah.
You can only, like in the worst case scenario, you have a 1 megahertz 6502 running a loop that moves the speaker. You can do some really creative things, but your palette is quite limited.
Sure.
As opposed to pre-rendering, what I do now, right? I can use anything I can record, I can put in the game.
Yeah.
So I could go and record the London Symphony Orchestra. I can put it in the game. I can layer up two dozen synthesizers and just enormous signal processing and all kinds of crazy audio techniques to create some stream that then just gets played back in the thing. And so I'm only limited there by how good I am in terms of how I can use the studio or how much money I have to go out and hire orchestras and stuff. That's the good news. The bad news is that it's all dead fish.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not lively. It's not responsive. I mean, you can do something about that, but you have to basically brute force it. When I play these wonderful streams of audio, they're dead. I can do nothing with them. They just play.
Right.
And worse than that is I know nothing about them unless I do something tricky. Meaning,
right.
Meaning if I wanted to synchronize something in the game world or in the audio world with a stream that I've started, all I know is I started it and it's running. But
maybe
I don't know.
Maybe the time code on it, maybe.
I don't, well, but anything else that I would know about it, I would have to do artificially to it.
Right.
Now, if I'm synthesizing it on a C64, I'm running a sequencer.
Right.
And I'm creating each audio element in time at runtime. And I know everything about it. I know where I am in the piece. I know about its time and its tempo. And I know where 16th notes are. And I know what key I'm playing in and what notes are being played. I know it all because I'm doing it.
Right.
So
Versus just starting it to go and just it goes.
Yeah.
Until it's done.
So there's this tension between beauty, you know, this pre-rendering all these wonderful elements and how opaque they are. And I know nothing about them. All I know is they're running. And this very rich synthesized world where the possibilities for changing them dynamically, synchronizing with them, to create new streams of audio dynamically at runtime that are some function of the interaction. So I can give you several examples of things that I've done that were wildly interactive music that was, from my point of view, functional, that everything that I did to create interactive sound was somehow bolted to the game, bolted to the interaction. You didn't even have to pay attention. If you're just playing and you can hear it, and after playing it a few times, you hear this cue, you may not understand it, but you know that something has happened, or
right.
You need to do something.
And it's not blatantly obvious. It's not like a good example is like a lot of these solo first the first person type adventure games that are out now. You'll be walking along and you'll be hearing this cute, nice music and it's nice and atmospheric and all of a sudden it's like boom 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 boom, you know, next thing you know something's gonna jump out of the trees at you. Because and it's scripted and you can tell.
Right, right. So the sound channel and all the elements of the sound channel, usually broken down three ways. There's voice and there's voice and dialogue, and there's music, and then there's everything else that's not those two. So there's effects. Everything that's there, from my point of view, should be there functionally.
Right.
And music is such a powerful thing, it maybe shouldn't be there sometimes. I mean, there's just this sort of a notion from a lot of people, it's just, well, music should be playing all the time. And I'm not with that either. I think it's you, because it's playing all the time, you blunt that knife by using it all the time until it becomes a very dull axe.
You've reduced its effectiveness.
Yes. So, to wrap this notion up, is present and past, clearly the sounds in the past had the potential. Not everybody did it, but you could be very interactive, and I could give some functional examples of the really interactive scores that I've done. Now, what I have now, and what's typically done now, it's much more of a challenge to be interactive. Plus, in the current environment, I'm not a programmer in the current environment. Clearly, right. I was in the past. But now I've got a programmer between me and the stuff that I need, except I don't have a sound programmer, like the guy from Sony. I don't have him. The guy who programmed the sound system is the game programmer, and he's busy. And if I need something done to make something more interactive, I probably get triaged off the list most of the time.
Right, and there's more people to answer to on the way up too, right? I mean, when you're talking three guys making a game and maybe some sort of a PM or something, now you've got seven layers of people you'd have to go through, and in the end, you probably wouldn't get your way anyway.
Right. Well, I've been lucky in some ways. I look at it. Let's look at it in a positive way. When I resumed my career, I kind of went back to something I had done before, and for the last 5 years, I'm working on my 13th pinball audio deliverable, and it's lucky for me in the sense that pinball is a perfect size of audio project for the lone wolf developer.
Right.
For what needs to be done, I can get it all done in spades and get it all done in the amount of time that's available, and I never have to take a meeting.
And as a bonus,
I do everything.
As a bonus, you don't have a scripted dead fish environment to work in. It's very alive, it's very reactive, and it's not like you play the same pinball game twice in a row, even though it's the same table and you're the same person. It's a different experience every single time.
Oh yeah. It's a fun interaction to augment. And audio for pinball, really, I've made the argument that it's one of the more important things, because a pinball player playing pinball is almost functionally blind.
This is true.
Because they spend all their time staring at the bottom third of the playfield, mostly. They'll glance up, they're trying to keep track of a bunch of stuff. But functionally, to play, it's that interaction between the flippers and the ball, and they're very, very busy. It's a very eyes-busy task. So now if you want to tell them things, the dot display is of limited use. They're not going to look up there.
That's true. I didn't think about that.
That orange fluorescent display, it's nice, but it's not really for the player. Then you have all the lights on the playfield, and a light is on, a light is off, a light is flashing. A good player will register that fact, but that's not all that rich. On, off, it's not that big a deal.
Right.
So the audio channel for a pinball machine is perfect to convey all the things that you want to tell them about a monitored interaction. What mode are you in? What should you be trying to do now? What have you just achieved? Oh, you've just done something wonderful.
Hurry up.
Time is running out. Hurry up. Oh, you've done all the things that are necessary to set up the machine so that if you do such and such, you will start multi-ball. So you are in a graced state, a wonderful state. All that stuff, which makes the thing more fun, you create, you know, tension, rewards, understanding, you know, feeling a mastery after playing it for a while that, you know, you understand. That an awful lot of that can come, should come from the audio channel. So it's a great project because as opposed to a video game where it's just assumed that all that stuff will come from you staring at the screen and audio augments it. For a pinball machine, I would argue that the sound is really one of the primary channels for the interaction to inform the player.
Well, folks, that's going to wrap up part one of the David Thiel interview. Join us in January 2011 for the second part of the David Thiel interview. Did I tell you it was fantastic or what? It was just a pure joy to talk to this guy. He's very excitable about his craft and the history behind it. Fascinating. I could have talked to the guy for days. But I hope you enjoyed this month's interview, and remember, tune in for part two next month right here on Retro Gaming Radio. We had a huge turnout for Bits and Bytes this month, so I've got tons of goodies to share with you. First of one I've kept in the back burner for the last couple of months just because I was waiting for the right time to pull it out. This seemed like a good enough time. I've talked a lot in the past about a little handheld electronic game called Digital Derby from Tommy, and it's a essentially two little film strips with little cars painted on them. You steer a little plastic car that's attached directly to the steering wheel. You have two speeds, one of which simply makes one of the film strips go faster. And if you collide with one of the cars, it buzzes and flashes red. You probably know what I'm talking about. If not, I'm sure that Alex has already provided you with a link to see what a Digital Derby looks like. Well, somebody came up with something called the Video Game in a Box. And this was sent in by myself, so I don't have anybody to credit for this one. But I thought this was really interesting. It's very similar to the way that Digital Derby was done. And it's a Mario knockoff using scrolling paper and a control knob on the side of a plain, regular old cardboard box. So this is pretty cool stuff. Take a look at it, see what you think. And if you're a big Digital Derby fan, this will be right up your alley. Okay, so here's an interesting development in the once great giant Atari lifespan. It seems that Atari is looking to reinvent itself as a mobile games company, and they hired an Iwan Marvel exec to be their executive VP. Now, normally speaking, I would say this would be a fairly poor move, but being is that Atari has such a great wealth of classic games, games that work very well in a, what's the word I'm looking for, less technical environment, right? They've got a whole stable full of properties that would make a great translation over to mobile devices, especially mobile devices that maybe have a physical means of control, like say the Sony Xperia, or to a device that has some means of hooking a joystick up to it, like a tablet. So for Atari, this seems like a pretty decent move. They've taken their stab at trying to keep up in the latest digital age, and let's be honest, that's not where Atari's strengths lie. So it's very nice to see that Atari is actually trying to play to their strengths, and I'll be really interested to see how this turns out. Let's see, what else do I have here? Oh, hey, there's a new HD version of our classic game Choplifter coming out for Xbox Live, PlayStation Network, and for the PC. Konami and InXile Entertainment are going to co-publish this title. Supposedly sometime this winter. I don't even know if it's been out yet. I haven't heard. But you remember the old Choplifter game, right? It was a side-scroller. You played in a chopper. You shot down enemies that were trying to roll over your little guys. You landed the chopper. The guys hopped on. You flew the chopper back to base. You dropped them off, wash, rinse, and repeat. So, it's a classic formula. It works very well. And as long as I don't mess with the formula too much, I think it could be great. It's a game that could definitely benefit from better graphics, And again, the gameplay should be fairly simple to keep straightforward. So we'll be watching that one closely. Hey, Alex J. Lopez sent in that he, well, he, by the way, he sent in that Atari one as well. Alex sent in, my producer sent in this interesting Space Invaders article. In Sacramento County, California, people have been tagging little 8-bit Space Invaders on signs with spray. You know, they're either stickers or spray paint. It's weird that they're popping up all over this county. So it's kind of funny that Space Invaders are, instead of taking over the world, are taking over one little California town, Elk Grove, California. That's pretty funny. Anyway, I'll post, we'll give you the link there right on the Retro Gaming Radio TV viewer. Let's see. I thought that was fun. Here's another one sent in. Let me take a look here, make sure I'm giving proper credit where credit is due. Let's see. Oh, here we go. Alex J. Lopez also sent in. A lot of people collect classic handhelds, including the original Game Boy. Well, apparently, one of the ways that people overhaul these things is to add a backlight. Well, Alex wanted to send in this thing called the V3 Triple LED Backlight. Essentially, it features three high-intensity LEDs strategically placed on the bottom of the panel, allowing for the easiest installation of a kit into a Game Boy ever. These panels fit perfectly into the plastic housing, meaning you no longer have to cut any of the plastic surroundings of your liquid crystal display for installation. So it sounds like if you've been wanting to do some sort of a light-up kit for your classic Game Boy, it sounds like the way to do it. And for $15, doesn't sound too bad. Now, this kills me. Now, this isn't classic gaming related, this particular piece, but a lot of you know that I personally take credit for inventing Redbox, the red box that sits at the various outlet locations that rent you DVDs for a buck. In the early 80s, I created something called the Video Vendor. I had this all put down on a napkin. Unfortunately, I didn't patent it, so I lost out. But essentially, I had a large box that sits at retail locations that, using a credit card, you would purchase rentals of videotapes, VHS videotapes. And you would return it to the same location. And it had markings on the side of the containers and a barcode scanner. I had it all sketched out. And sure enough, you know, sometime down the road, somebody else pops up with it. But I still think I was the first person to have the idea. Anyway, so my friend Justin and I, we hang out a lot at lunchtime. He works with me. And we were talking about the other day about a formula show based on classic video games, where we would go out, Justin and I would go out, and we would find collectors, people who have old games sitting in their shed, they don't know what to do with, they inherited them or something like that, show people restoring them, all that sort of thing. Well, so funny, I swear to God, my whole life is bugged, because along comes this pilot show called High Score, which is supposed to be the reality show for classic arcade games. Now, there's a video, a sizzle reel. Just to give you a little, the premise of what drives High Score is an in-development reality show that focuses on TNT Amusements, a Pennsylvania showroom that specializes in the acquisition, restoration, and sale of old coin-operated video game machines. The video above is a sizzle reel to help the show find a home on network television. There's clearly a reality show template at work here, like American Pickers or American Restorations. Find a person who has, wants thing, find or make desired thing, and have the staff do their crafty things to the desired thing and deliver the finished desired thing. You know, watching this video, this is exactly what I wanted to do. So once again, I snoozed, I lose. But anyway, it's a fun reel to look at. This is definitely a show I'd watch it in a heartbeat. I mean, there's some horrible shows about American hoggers and people restoring motorcycles. The least we can do is have something of a classic video game nature. Let's see. Todd Holcomb wrote back in and let us know that for Christmas, a brand new 4-game Atari 2600 cartridge is coming out called The Bite Before Christmas. They just had a contest to try to get somebody to make them a label for their game, and unfortunately the deadline for that has passed. But this has 4 different games in it. All, of course, are Santa or Christmas-related. And let's see, what's the list of games here? We've got Naughty List, Bell Hopper, Santa's Scabs, and Christmas Adventure, which looks like a little adventure-type knockoff game. These all look really good, I mean, as 2600 games go, and I know that there's a lot of diehard 2600 collectors. So the Bite Before Christmas, this is the label contest that we're going to link you to, but you can get the whole deal. And unfortunately, I'm sorry, Todd, I know you sent me a beta to look at of the games, and I simply did not get to it this month. But I tell you what, if I do get a chance to take a look at it, I'll throw it on my tablet or on my cell phone, and I'll give them a whirl in an emulator, and maybe I'll do a little follow-up. But it's always nice to see classic gaming development still going on, so I like to really support this. Thanks, Todd, for sending that in. The next thing I want to talk to you about is sort of classic gaming related, but we're going to talk about it anyway. Over in California, of course, is Disneyland, and attached to Disneyland is the less popular California Adventures. Well, inside of California Adventures, if you go in and head to the left, there's a great place called Electronica. And what it is it is a virtual world of Tron Legacy, the new Tron movie that came out just about a couple years back. Anyway, this whole place is decked out, full Tron deck out with the neon and the glow. They've got one of the full light cycles there, one of the new ones, not one of the old ones. But forget about all the new Tron Legacy stuff. Forget about the huge dance party and the guy that sits up and controls lasers with his hands and does this big laser light show and all the hot chicks dressed up in tight clothes. Forget about all that. What you're interested in is in the back of that lot is a little place called Flynn's Arcade. And it looks just like the movie from the outside. You go in, and there are classic games, and I've got pictures, and maybe I'll send them over to Alex and he can throw them into a slideshow or something. But you can actually go in there and play all these classic games. And they even have the Space Paranoids game that was created. It was a PC-based game, but they stuck it in an arcade cabinet, and it's actually a really damn hard game. And it's really pretty fun, too. So if you are looking for something else to do while you're at Disneyland and you're thinking about California Adventure, but maybe not, I'm a huge fan of California Adventure. I think Tower of Terror, what are some of the other great things over there? Soarin' Over California, there's a whole bunch of different attractions, but this is totally worth going to. You got people dressed up in Tron outfits or throwing around lit up memory discs or game discs. It's too freaking cool. The atmosphere will just blow you away. And I've got some video of that, too. Maybe I'll have Alex throw that up, although it's pretty jittery. You know, me running around by hand. But you definitely want to check that out if you get an opportunity to be over there. It's part of the admission price of California Adventure, so you're not paying anything else. It's fantastic, especially if you like that dance club atmosphere. It's all outside. It's crazy. It's wild. It's insane. All right, last up, because one of my links was broken, next up and last for this month is something called Polybius. I'm assuming that's how you pronounce it. Now, I don't understand how I've been running Retro Gaming Radio on and off for the past like 15 freaking years, and this item has never came across my desk, and I've never heard anything about it. Polybius is an urban legend video game. It's an arcade game that supposedly existed. Nobody can produce one. People have, Blair Witch Project videos of it. There's no ROM. There's all sorts. It's an amazing urban legend myth around this thing, and I don't understand how come I've never heard of this thing until Alex brought it to my attention this last month. And here's what coinop.org says about the game. The game had a very limited release, one or two backwater arcades in the suburb of Portland. The history of this game is cloudy. There were all kind of strange stories about how kids who played it got amnesia afterwards, couldn't remember their name or where they lived, etc. The bizarre rumors about this game are that it was supposedly developed by some kind of weird military tech offshoot group, used some kind of proprietary behavior modification algorithms developed for the CIA or something, kids who played it woke up at night screaming, having horrible nightmares. According to an operator who ran an arcade with one of these games, guys in black coats would come to collect records from the machine. They're not interested in quarters or anything, they just collected information about how the game was played. The game was weird looking, kind of abstract, fast action with some puzzle elements. The kids who played it stopped playing games entirely. One of them became a big anti-video game crusader or something. We've contacted one person who met him, and he claims the machines disappeared after a month or so, and nobody ever heard about them again. I'm sorry, man, but that's like got to be the coolest urban legend when it comes to video games ever. There's a little bit more information if you search the net. But it's funny, this thing even has made it into Simpsons, which is interesting. In the Simpsons episode, and this is on this link you'll see here, Please Homer, Don't Hammer Him, Bart goes up to play a video game called Triangle Wars, and right next to it is a Polybius machine. Totally bizarre, right? There are people that have made cabinets. There's some photos here. There's, like I said, there's a Blair Witch video of some guy who found one hiding. It's crazy. Check it out. There's links to tons of other stuff. If nothing else, it's fascinating reading. At least it was for me. I got totally caught up in it. So very, very cool. Well, listen, thanks to everybody who sent stuff in. There are a few items that did not get pulled for this month just because we have a very large interview. Bits and Bytes is kind of the filler piece of the show to work around the other content. And we've got tons more coming up. If your information was not given this month, please check back next month as we're recycling through them. As always, you can submit your Bits and Bytes stories directly to us at bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com, bitsbytes@retrogamingradio.com, or if you can't remember, just go to retrogamingradio.com. We'll have a link there provided for you. This segment of the show is run just by people just like yourself, so please definitely write in. We get some of the best stuff from our listeners. This month, we're going to look at Zen Pinball THD, which that should let you know if you're an Android user that that requires the Tegra chipset for your Android device. Zen Pinball is, of course, makers of Pinball FX. It's very popular on the gaming consoles. Zen Pinball brings arcade authentic physics and pinball tables right to your Android Tegra device. Currently, it's only playable on Tegra devices, so you'll need one of the higher end tablets like the Asus Transformer in order to play this guy. But I do know that Zen Pinball is being ported to the Nintendo 3DS. I believe that Apple's iOS has a version of it as well, or it's coming. And I do believe that they are planning to release a non-Tegra version for Android. But what makes Zen Pinball so fantastic? Why am I bringing it up here on a retro gaming radio show? Well, you know I'm a huge pinball fan, right? My pinball lineage goes way, way back, all the way to the electromechanical stuff, and pretty much everywhere in between. I love classic tables, I love modern tables, and I like electronic tables. A lot of people know about Visual Pin Mame, or V-Pin Mame, where you can actually play authentic tables using two types of emulators. One is the table emulator, or table simulator, backed with actual game ROMs. I don't know where this project is now. It's been a long time since I've looked at it because, well, I own a pinball machine. I have tons of consoles and computers that play pinball, so I can get that Jones if I need it. Of course, I also have a great arcade nearby, classic gaming as well as pinball, Castles and Coasters, which has no less than, I think, 20 or 30 different pinball tables, along with all the newest ones and, of course, the best ones like Medieval Madness and Star Trek The Next Generation is one of my favorite of the modern ones. They have the Pinball 2000 ones. They have the Episode 1 and the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Was that the right one? I don't remember. It's been a while since I've been down there. But suffice to say, they've got a very, very spiffy collection of pinballs. And, of course, you know I own my own Bone Busters. So I have a lot of experience with pinball. And up until recently, some of the best pinball has been made by Zen, who have been making pinball effects for the 360, the PS3, and I've talked in the past about Pinball Pulse, which appears on the Nintendo DS platform from the DSiWare store, probably the best portable handheld pinball ever. And by the way, for those of you who are still jonesing to have that game on your Nintendo 3DS, if you maybe you got one for Christmas and you got your old DSi, you can now copy that pinball game over from the DSi over to your new 3DS. That's something we've all been waiting for. It's one of the last holdout games that for some reason couldn't be transferred when you bought the new 3DS. Now it can copy over. But let's get back to Zen Pinball. What makes Zen Pinball so great? Well, probably the best part of it is that it's free. You can actually get the Zen Pinball package right from the Android Market for free, and it comes with a table called Sorcerer's Lair, which a lot of people argue is a very, very, very good pinball. And I agree, it is very good. However, more tables can be purchased for just $1.99 a piece, which is reasonable, under $2. And you can download them. And the neat thing is these are full-blown tables. All the toys, all the missions, all the special multi-balls. Sometimes the tables jump a little outside the realm of pure pinball, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But it's really nice. For free, you can get a complete table, as well as this interface, the Zen Pinball interface, which is very nice. They spent a lot of time working on it. It does offer up through OpenFaint, which is a online connectivity, sort of like an Xbox Live or a Steam, only for mobile devices. And OpenFaint is cross-platform in some cases. Zen Pinball apparently is not. So if you're playing the iOS version of Zen Pinball, your scores with your friends will not appear in the Android version. And I'm not sure why that is. I mean, why advertise it as cross-platform if you can't do stuff like that, right? But suffice to say, the future possibilities there. Because of the OpenFaint connectivity, it allows you to really leverage the game, just like on the consoles, leverage the game with and against your friends. So currently we have a large heated battle going on amongst the Monroe World comrades, if you will. We have a very nice friendly friendly challenge going on, and it keeps track of your accumulated score amongst the pinballs. It gives you an overall ranking, and it ranks you amongst your friends. So it's really, really nice if the scoreboard keeps you on your toes with playing the pinball. But how does the pinball itself work? Now that's important, because pinball, there's two types of electronic pinball. Really, really good electronic pinball and really, really bad electronic pinball. And it usually boils down to one thing, which is realism. A lot of console and portable pinball games totally leave the realm of possibility. They have things trotting across the board. They have the ball doing things that are completely impossible to do. It's not a realistic table, and because of that, while it makes it more video game friendly, for purists of pinball, for people who really, really like pinball, the non-realistic, you know, ghosts flying across the table, picking up the ball and slamming it against the glass and doing all this other weird stuff, that loses the appeal for real top-notch pinball. The other thing, of course, which makes pinball great is physics. How realistic does the ball move? Because just like classic video game programmers who worked outside the rules of hardware, pinball aficionados really enjoy using the physics of the table to their advantage in terms of doing things like juggling the ball between flippers, right? You've seen the real top-notch guys do that, where they'll roll the ball right off the flipper and toss it right over to the other flipper as if it were magic. Some people can do that. Some people like to catch the ball in the pocket of the flipper when it comes down so they can set up the next shot. These are all things that aren't really possible if you have really loosey-goosey physics or unrealistic physics. Zen Pinball, I'm proud to say, is brilliant. The ball moves completely realistically. There's never a time when the pinball, dispels your belief that it's a pinball. There's a lot of times when you're playing these sort of pinball games, you have to suspend your disbelief considerably in order to get through the table. These games, these pinball, this pinball engine, I should say, of Zen Pinball is very, very honed. These guys, you can tell, this is what these guys do, and they are very good at it. A lot of times you'll see with these sort of electronic pinball games, you'll see times when the ball will speed up really fast for no reason, just in a certain patch from some piece of weird physics code, or when you hit it with the flipper, you don't impart the energy you would have expected to go. And this is the suspension of disbelief that we shouldn't have to deal with as pinball lovers. Zen Pinball's got that covered. The last thing about pinball, for me, personally, now some people love the old electromechanical pinballs. They love the chasing of the score. And the chasing of the score means that you're just going purely for score. That's great. Essentially, the longer you can keep the ball on the play field doing something other than going down the drink or holding it, you're scoring points. For some people, that is key. Me personally, there's a few elements of pinball that really, really excite me. One, I like missions. I like mission-based pinball. I like, instead of just knocking down targets and then letting them reset and knocking them down again and then letting them reset and walking the lights along the dropout chutes, that's all fun. But what's more fun is being able to actually purposefully launch a mission and then perform the mission and then set it up, rig it up, and run another mission. I like mission-based pinball. Most pinball machines, at least currently, probably in the last 10 to 15 years, all have missions, even if they're just multi-ball lock type missions, and that works for me too. I like a diverse play field. I like segregated areas of the play field. I like being able to work one area of a play field. One example is Black Knight 2000. Very specifically, there's a top level of the play field and a bottom level, and each one has its own particular missions or whatever it is that you need to get done. And you know, keeping it up in the top play field keeps it away from the scary drink, but all of the good points and all the best bonuses are on the bottom play field where the biggest risk is. The best designed pinball machines have all of this, plus they have what I call savvy. There's a way the boards can be constructed. There are ways the boards can be constructed that is intuitive to fun. And then there's other boards. You've played these. You know what I'm talking about. There are pinball machines that, while they're loud and obnoxious and have lights and there's so much crap going on, you're playing it going, this is just boring. I don't like the way, I don't like the layout of the table. You know, there's no incentive for me to do double loops or sky loops or whatever it is that you call them. There are pinball terms, by the way, for all this stuff. And listening to the interview or talking to David Thiel revealed a bunch of this. They have tons of explanatory phrases for these areas of pinball. I have my own names for them, and unfortunately, I'm stuck in my ways. I do like toys and gadgets, as long as they're kept realistic and they actually offer some fun to the game. And we're going to talk about some of the toys and whatnot of these tables that are available. Currently, outside of Sorcerer's Lair, there are three tablet-based versions of tables available. And they're all three Marvel tables. There's a Wolverine table, a Fantastic Four table, and recently just came out a Thor table. So hopefully you like Marvel, and hopefully you like superhero tables, because other than Sorcerer's Lair, that's pretty much what you got currently going around. Now, that's not the same on the consoles, right? So if you were playing pinball effects on the consoles, you would have some of the same tables, but you would also have a greater variety. Now, the slots available on the main screen of Zen Pinball, and I'm assuming that Alex is going to have some queued up video and some screenshots for you on the RGR Plus TV player, one of those groovy things you get if you're watching the show on the website instead of listening to it as a podcast. You're going to get a chance to see some of this stuff, and we do have video of the different tables. And every time a table comes out, I like to shoot some video and share it with people because some tables rub people differently. Wolverine and Fantastic Four are both very well done tables. They are realistic tables. They don't tend to step outside the boundaries of possibility. And I really like that. I like realistic tables. My favorite tables come from developers that I could literally see walking into an arcade right now and seeing the Wolverine table or the Fantastic Four table. I don't need them to be actual pinball tables, though. I would love to see Black Knight 2000 come to a home platform. I don't know why I haven't seen it. Black Knight's made it, but never Black Knight 2000. I would love to see Black Knight 2000 make it to a home platform. But it's okay to come up with new tables as long as they play by the rules. And Wolverine and Fantastic Four are both tables that give you the feeling of playing a real, exact table. Thor, on the other hand, while it has all the elements of a proper table, even from pulling the plunger back, which isn't a plunger but a slingshot, like a catapult, from that point forward, you're feeling like this isn't a real table. It's a fantasy table. It's an electronic video game pinball table. And unfortunately, that kind of ruins some of the fun for me. I don't like to be pulled out of that realism of pinball. So we're going to cover each of the tables just a little bit in just a moment. But I'm actually... All right, you caught me. I'll come clean. One of the tables is actually missing. I had to rebuild. I rebuilt my Transformer tablet. There was a new update, and if you decide to root your tablet, at least your Transformer, if you root it and give yourself that sort of access, when a new update comes out, you have to roll the Transformer back to stock, install the update, and then reroot it. Wash, rinse, and repeat. So I'm rebuilding my Transformer right now, and I was missing this one table. But we're going to look at each one of these tables just a little bit, just to give you an idea what to expect. Again, the Sorcerer's Lair table is free, and they've already had discount bargains on some of the other tables. Not Thor, but Wolverine and Fantastic Four have been on sale for $1 apiece. Now listen, those of you who've put massive amounts of cash into your favorite pinball tables know that $1 is nothing. All right. Before we look at the table, though, I want to tell you about some of the things that the interface gives you as part of the leaderboard system through OpenFaint. The first tab tells you about the table that you currently have highlighted. Next up are your local high scores, leaderboards for your friends for this table, the challenge, in other words, who's got the best score on the table. Gives you a picture of your opponent, and it tells you how many more points you need from your last score to beat him. You also have your pro score, which is a culmination of your points between the tables. They give you they calculate it through an algorithm. They give you a pro score, so you see how you stack up to your friends. Currently, who has the best pro score challenge, which isn't me, and then a team score with your friends. They calculate a score for each table based on you and your friends' scores. So I'm going to pull up the Sorcerer's Lair table in case Alex wants to pull up the fun along with us in the video window. Sorcerer's table kind of gives you almost a little Harry Potter feel to it. There's several different flippers. A spinner, a floor spinner, sort of like Whirlwind. A couple of nice gadgets, a sorcerer-looking guy, a golem, and a number of different flippers, several ramps, a couple of steel rim ramps, this giant tree that looks more like he's showing you the business. And, of course, all of these games come complete with a dot matrix display, which gives you in-game video mode type things. The table's very, very clean. Now, again, because this table comes with it, a lot of the extra multimedia stuff doesn't... I mean, there's still speech and there's still good music and sound effects in this table, but nothing as rich, I should say, as the other tables because they're large downloads. So, let's take a look at... Let me go back to some of the other tables real quick. Oh, they do. Let me talk a little bit about this. They do give you table guides, which are overviews that tell you each and everything about the table, the different challenges to do on each table, and how to start the different missions, which I thought was really nice of them. For example, let's see. Let's just go through. I'll do the one that's included. They give you some general overview. Shoot the magic cellar for different challenges on every visit. Gather as many enchanted obsidian stones as possible and unlock their power against the sorcerer's creation. So this is sort of the general overview. Next one tells you about the cellar modes. In order to gain entrance to the mysterious cellar, the three guardian stones need to be hit first. When the stairway emerges, the cellar is exposed to the next stage of discovery. And they're actually showing you the table on the left as well, which is really cool. Drawing energy from the unknown realm. This is Gates to the Void. The unknown realm of the void, the sorcerer wishes to trick our explorers by teleporting them once they enter one of the four gates to the void summons. The children need to avoid these gates and also seek a way to destroy them. Fortunately, Whisper, the friendly ghost girl, who is helping them on their adventures, and assistant, destroy all four gates to be granted an obsidian. And this goes on and on. Bones. The sorcerer's lair is full of long-forgotten creatures, including skeletons that tirelessly chase the kids through the corridors. Run away from the skeletons by shooting the spinners and the bumpers as fast as you can, and you can win an obsidian upon your escape, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. And they show you close-ups of the table, too, so that you can see the different areas that they're talking about. So that's really, really neat. Let's see, what else can I tell you about Sorcerer's Lair? Most people actually like Sorcerer's Lair better than the Marvel tables, and I'm not exactly sure why, because I like Wolverine and Fantastic Four more. But let me tell you something special, though, about the THD piece of this. Zen Pinball THD is Tegra High Definition. Tegra High Definition means that essentially there is a incredibly capable, just as good as a console graphics card in these devices. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, no, there's no way a tablet looks as good as my high-def television, whatnot. Not true. These are full high-definition tables. And because it uses a superior graphic subsystem like Tegra, there's no hiccups, there's no slowdowns, there's no anything. It is like you are playing a high-definition console. It is fantastic. You almost have to see it in person to believe that it looks that good. Let's move on. The other tables, Wolverine. I can bring this up. Wolverine has what I call more of an open playfield type play. Most of the center of the table and top and bottom of the center of the table are very open. This is a very ramp-driven game. There's plenty of toys. There's plenty of little gizmos on the screen. There's a whirlwind area that picks up the ball and spins it within. You've got a whole bunch of characters on the game as well. This, I guess, is probably one of the benefits of being able to download a full new game like this instead of just the one that's included. Lots more audio, lots more media. It's a very beautiful game. And let me see here. I just want to pan around the table. You are given many different views of the table. In fact, there are a total of 8. Different views. One is more your top overview. One's more helicopter. One's more behind the seat. One chases the ball more. One gives you a better look at the play field as the ball goes through. So you can continue to sit here and pan through the views until you find exactly which one best suits your play style. Now, because it's high definition, even the extended pulled-out views of the table are very detailed and clean. Plenty to see and do with the Wolverine table. Now, let's go back and take another quick peek at some of the other tables. Fantastic Four may be the best table so far, simply because it's got a lot of steel, a lot of steel ramps, which I like. I like that look, and I like the feel. I like watching the ball travel a lot of steel girders. It's fairly open in the middle of the play field. Plenty of ramps, plenty of drop-down targets, a couple of toys to play with, and, of course, your standard shoots at the top. Dr. Doom has an appearance on here as well, Thing, of course, and all the Fantastic Four. Now, the only thing about Fantastic Four is they occasionally jump out of the realm of possible pinball. by having some of the missions make use of the toys in a slightly unrealistic way, which is too bad because that kind of ruins some of the fun. But still, it's a fantastic table, and I recommend it to anybody. Very good missions, too. The mission base on this one was pretty good, as I remember. Going back, though, and once again, we're going to look really quick at Thor. Sorry, I'm trying to navigate this at the same time. Now, I like the Thor property, but you can tell when you look at this that it's a very fanciful table. There's a lava mountain that's actually hanging off the side of the table. There's ice where the ball gets launched. There are a number of liquid pools that are unrealistic to the pinball genre. Of course, I mentioned this, the catapult. There's a lot of unusual ways for the ball to disappear, you know, up into the backboard and some other things. It's a neat table, but it's not a real, if you don't have a problem, I guess, with, you know, video game pinball, this is probably going to be your favorite table. If you're like me, though, and you're really, really into pure pinball, this is a little too fanciful of a table to be taken completely seriously. So once again, we've been talking about Zen Pinball, THD, the Tegra-only version for the Android platform. There's a couple phones out that have Tegra already, and of course, there's numerous tablets that have Tegra capabilities. This is really a showpiece. In addition to being a fantastic pinball game, it really leverages the hardware. It is something you won't be ashamed to show this to anybody. I don't care if they're console gamers, if they're iPad owners, whether they've got iPhones, whether they've got Android phones. If you want to really show off how clean this game is, you will not have a problem doing so. Now, there is a couple of things we need to talk about. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait a minute, Shane, this is a tablet. How do you hit the flippers? Because the other thing with pinball is it's a tactile medium. People who use flipper buttons to play pinball are not going to be thrilled using touch controls. Now, they implemented the touch controls the best they could, but let's be honest. In the end, tapping on the screen is not the same effect, the same tactile experience that it is if you are touching an actual button, an arcade button. I'm going to tell you, though, for those of you who are Android tablet gamers, I've started a little site called The Green Robot Gamer. GreenRobotGamer.com, and it's a wiki, so you can go and contribute to it all you'd like. What I've done is I've come up with ways of using standard controllers like Xbox controllers, PlayStation controllers, Wii controllers. These are the sort of things that I want to use when I'm playing video games. I don't want to use a touchscreen. I don't want to use a virtual D-pad. I don't want to use virtual buttons or anything else. I want to use real buttons and real D-pads and real joysticks. Nicely enough, Zen Pinball already has most of its functionality mapped to physical controls if you have them available. For example, if you have the Sony Xperia phone, you already have a D-pad and four buttons. This game will work with that out of the box. If what you have is an Android tablet or an Android phone without physical buttons, what you do is you use this little program called USB / Bluetooth Joystick Center, and you can then hook up a Bluetooth controller to the tablet. Those of you who've been following GameStop recently know that's what they're doing with their gaming tablets, is providing you with a physical controller that links in through Bluetooth to the tablet. Now, using this USB Joy program, you can easily map your Wiimote. Now, hey, your Wii's been sitting in the cabinet, not getting any love. You've got a dusty remote sitting on a charger that you haven't been using. Drag that sucker off. Go pay a couple bucks for this USB Joy program. And you can then hook this guy up and play all your favorite things, including MAME, using the Wii controller. That's what I've done in order to make this game extremely playable. Now, people are enjoying it with touch controls as best they can. However, it's a different game, as you know, being able to use a real physical. I use the Wiimote on its side, and I use technically the up or the left D-pad direction as well as button 2 to control my pinball. And you'll see that in one of the videos of the Thor table. I didn't have that rigged up before for the other tables when I shot video, but for Thor I did. So that gives you an idea how you can really leverage, and believe me, this is the best time. You can play in both landscape and portrait, so you get to see more of the table lengthwise or heightwise, depending on what you like. It's a fantastic deal. Again, it's free. I mean, there's no reason not to. If you've got a Tegra device, if you've got an iPad 2, which I believe that they've got it released for that, if you've got a console and you want to play the same similar pinball games, get Pinball FX or Pinball FX 2. Fantastic stuff. I can't recommend Zen Pinball enough for anybody who's a diehard pinball player who's looking to take the experience back to their house. Well, that's going to wrap up our Zen Pinball. Next up, the Atari Greatest Hits package for Android. Boy, let me tell you something about this Atari Hits. This is absolutely crazy, this package. First of all, they allow you to download the package with a couple of free games. I think you can get Missile Command for free and a couple of others. And it's I'll tell you what, they have a very nice interface. It's a beautiful display. You have to do it in the portrait mode, though, on your tablet or on your phone. And this is out for iOS as well, but the version that I'm looking at, I'll be covering for Android. So we have a number of different platforms here. This is very similar, okay, to all of the other Atari packages you've seen in the past. This time, though, we've got it for the mobile or the tablet devices. All right. So they offer 100 different games. This is Atari 2600 and arcade games. I know what a lot of you are thinking. Just tell me about the arcade games. I don't care about the 2600 games. So let me give you the rundown of arcade games. Asteroids, Asteroid Deluxe, Battle Zone, Black Widow, which I can't believe is in there, Centipede, Crystal Castles, Gravatar, Liberator, Lunar Lander, Major Havoc, always my favorite, Millipede, Missile Command, Pong, Red Baron, which is kind of cool, you never see that one, or is it Red Baron, Space Duel, Super Breakout, Tempest, and Warlords. Overall, a very solid little package of arcade games. Okay, some of them we've seen a million times, right? Some of them you never really wanted to play, like Crystal Castles. But then you've got some amazing titles like Red Baron and Black Widow. I mean, those things never come up in the arcade, in the home packages. Now I could spend a zillion years telling you what's in the Atari 2600 piece of it. but you're going to see things like Yar's Revenge, Warlords, Video Pinball. I'm just going to give you the highlights. Tempest, all the Sword Quest. Well, two of the Sword Quests. Guess which one's missing. Let's see. Actually, no, not for this package. All the Sword Quests are here. Let's see. Super Breakout, Street Racer, Steeplechase, Starship, Star Raiders, Space War, Slot Machine and Slot Racers, heaven help us, Skydiver, Return to Haunted House, all the real sports are in here, I think, football, baseball, basketball, etc., Radar Lock, Quadron, Outlaw, always nice to have that one in there, Night Driver, Missile Command, Millipede, if you're watching the video, I'm hoping that that Alex will find a video of all of these things being scrolled through so you can see if your favorite game's in here. Dodge 'em, Demons to Diamonds, Crystal Castles, Combat, thank God, Circus Atari, Centipede, Canyon Bomber, Breakout, Bowling, Battle Zone. Pretty much, if Atari put out a title and it sold more than like 10 copies, it's in here. Air Sea Battle, Adventure, of course, is in here. That's the other one everyone wants to know. Now, here's... It's great. First of all, they give you a variety of different control options, which is unlike them to do that. Usually they do not give you that sort of flexibility with these packages. And you can turn on and off music. You can turn up the volume of the music and the game and the effects and all that good stuff, as you would hope. But there's really nice arcade representation of each cabinet. Let's go to Major Havoc. I'm going to select that. It comes up. You have a gallery. And when you do select the gallery, it does hit the internet, and it brings you up a few things. For in this case, it gives you the the brochure, the pamphlet that they sent out. They give you that for Major Havoc. It's nice. It's not fantastic, but it's nice. For controls on Major Havoc, they allow you to they give you a virtual roller, which is kind of fun, and a couple of buttons, of course, is what you need. And then they'll let you put it in whatever orientation you want. So you can put it in, landscape or portrait. So they really do give you, let me give you just an example. They let you adjust the sensitivity too. Let me give you an example. In Major Havoc, you've got portrait roller on the left, portrait roller on the right, landscape roller on the left overlaid, landscape roller on the right overlaid. So you've got a bunch of different options depending on what hand you are and where you like to have the controller. It's as well done as it's going to get, okay? Here is the bad part. Now, they're promising multiplayer and leaderboards soon. Now, we haven't seen that yet, but they've put out a few updates to this thing so far, so it's not outside the realm of possibility. Oh, by the way, they do give you a nice little organizational piece as well, so you can not only look at like the recently played games, but the arcade games A to Z, 2600 A to Z, and then all the 2600 ones are broken down into pieces: action, adventure, arcade, gambling, mind games, racing. How many gambling can there be? Gambling consists of blackjack, casino, and slot machines. All right, great. Anyway, so I was an early adopter. I was one of the first people, I think, that saw this. In fact, I think you'll find that my comment on the title is one of the first, if not the first, on the title on the Android market. There's two problems with this. One is the payment system. Now, you can download Atari Greatest Hits for free. They give you one or two games, and then the rest are buy-ins inside the game. The problem is... they sell it to you in minor packs. They sell it to you in chunks. And I wish I remembered exactly the monetary conventions that they used. Once you buy, you can buy the whole package too. You can unlock the entire thing for, I can't remember what it was that they wanted for it. I think it was, it might have been $8 or $9 to buy the entire 100 game pack. Unfortunately, their servers or whatever they needed to contact to authorize the purchase didn't get me hooked up. I paid, and it says, well, your game purchases will be available shortly. And it wasn't, and it wasn't, and it wasn't, and it wasn't, and it wasn't. And finally, I wrote into the Atari support email, and I said, listen, it's not working. Help us out. And, of course, everyone's one-starring this app down the line. One star, one star, one star, one star, one star. Won't give me my things. The worst part is the way that they set up the purchases in the interface is slightly misleading. You think you're buying them all, but you're only buying one of the three packs for $1, right? I think I went through two or three different three packs before I finally figured out how to buy all. So when you do get this game, if you're going to try it out, make sure you look very closely before you do any buying, and make sure you're getting the entire enchilada and not just one or two or three different games that they're selling in a package format. So be careful about that. The last thing that makes this game set less than usable is the fact that none of the controls inside the game are actually mapped to physical controls. Remember I mentioned earlier in the Zen Pinball understood that if there was a D-pad available, if there were buttons available, like on the Xperia phone, go ahead and map them to the controls. There is none of that going on with the Atari Classic Pack, and that is very, very unfortunate, because the package would actually be a decent deal with some great unusual games if we could map some damn physical controls to the thing, which we cannot. So that would be the one thing that now it's possible they'll add it. You know, enough people bitch and whine about it, they might add it. I got that done with Dragon's Lair, which you're going to find out about next month. I cried and whined until I could play Dragon Slayer with my remote control. And they hooked me up. They did it. And that release is going to be out by the time you hear this, I'm sure it'll be pushed out. But most of these developers on Android, and I'm sure on iOS too, I don't want to piss anybody off, I'm sure that the developers are really looking to expand this market, and they're listening. Most of the developers that I've written to, especially on the Android platform, have been very helpful, very open to suggestion, and many of them have added a multitude of useful suggestions that I've put in for them. So, you know, enough people talk about it, we'll get it pushed through, I'm sure. It can't be that hard. You know, a lot of games already have that set up. So that would be it for the Atari's Greatest Hits. I recommend you take a look at it, especially the free games. See how the interface looks. Maybe purchase the two or three games that you like on their own. You have to buy them in packs. But don't forget, you know, at some point in time you're going to say, well, crap, I just bought five packs and the whole game costs $8. I should have just paid the $8. So keep that in mind as you are looking through what you would like to pick up as part of this package. Otherwise, it looks pretty good. The emulation is rock solid. I like that. The controls, well, you know, virtual controls don't work for me. Touchscreen controls are not my favorite thing to do unless a game is written specifically for them. I will tell you, though, Missile Command plays pretty damn good by dragging your finger across the screen instead of the trackball. And then using the three buttons to launch from whatever station, that actually works pretty good. And Missile Command's the freebie, so give it a try. Well, that's going to do it for the reviews this month. We touched on Zen Pinball THD and Atari's Greatest Hits. Next month, we're going to be looking at Dragon's Lair for the Android, as well as the iCade Mini Arcade Cabaret-style Bluetooth unit that you can take your tablet and play your favorite games with real arcade controls. So stick around for that next month. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for the 2011 broadcasting year and, of course, the December show. I did want to make sure that everybody knew to check out Retro Gaming Radio Plus. That is our 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, classic Retro Gaming Radio Shoutcast server. Go to shoutcast.com, type in Retro Gaming Radio, and you can listen to the classic shows for free 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There are Shoutcast streaming applications for Android, iPhone, your PC. You can listen to it right on the website. So catch up on all your favorite classic episodes. And don't forget to join us on the Retro Gaming Radio website for the HTML5 Retro Gaming Radio Plus TV Viewer. That allows you to not only listen to the show, but we pump in timely videos while you're watching and listening to the show. And we present to you with these links that we talk about right here. An in-screen browser will automatically take you to those. You can bookmark them or pop them into new windows to look at later. It's a really neat system. We're constantly working to try to improve it. Again, it's an HTML5 deal, so you'll have to use the latest browser. Most of you are already up on that anyway. But again, next month, don't forget, we've got the Dragon's Lair Android review, the iCade Bluetooth-enabled arcade cabaret mini cabinet that you put your tablet into and play, MAME. We got tons of stuff coming for next year. It's going to be very, very busy. And, of course, part two of the David Thiel interview will be next month as well. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying, until next time, keep it retro.